session number 19531, Reel 3.
Peter Betts, Reel 3.
Yes, it was in a way, looking back, rather surprising that they welcomed us back with open arms. But of course, it was a great relief of having got rid of the Japanese. And I suppose also, I'm being a little cynical about it, the vast numbers of people in Singapore are only too glad to have the British back, on whom they depended for their livelihood in many ways. So I suppose that, in a way, it was natural. But anyway, it was very exciting to march up in open order through Chinatown with all the people sort of waving and cheering and leaning out of the shop houses and all the rest of it. But we actually, at that stage, weren't all that sure that the Japanese were going to give up properly. So that first night, we took up, as it were, positions, mounted our Bren guns and posted our sentries and so on, just to make sure there was no armed reaction on the part of the Japanese. There wasn't. They were completely submissive. They produced all the transport they had for our use, and there wasn't the slightest problem at all. The second first and myself included, moved into a residential area, Mount Pleasant, very nice European houses. And, quite interesting, because apart from that brief period in Rangoon, I mean, we hadn't seen tarmac roads and Arakan. It was all sort of brick and laterite. And there was a kind of feeling of sudden civilization, you know, and things that worked. And I always remember going into this house to which had been allocated to me and Mike Lingen, one of the Punjabi officers, with our orderlies. They'd given me one of theirs. And there was sort of Western furniture everywhere, and a refrigerator in the kitchen, which was actually frozen solid. And so one of the orderlies decided he'd try and chip away the ice with his bayonet, and he managed to pierce the gas container, so we could gas out of that house for a little while. But it was fun. I mean, the Singapore environment was amusing and pleasant, and there were sort of dance halls and restaurants and sort of... One felt that it was a sort of holiday in a way. It was rather fun. But I had to some extent, get involved with the use of the Japanese, because we were using them as labourers to clear up various aspects of Singapore. They were made to work as dockers and as labourers around the camps and that sort of thing. And so there was a good deal of allocation of duties, but they were all completely responsive, no problem at all. It was really extraordinary to think that they'd been fighting to the death up north only a short while ago. And here they were just, as it were, not quite slaves, but certainly offering no resistance at all, and tremendous obedience to everything they were told to do.
What were they asked to do?
Well, they were asked to clear the ditches for anti-malarial purposes, drain the pools, get rid of the mosquitoes, make up some of the roads which needed a bit of repair, that sort of thing. The physical labour, basically. Coolie labour, you might say. But they were fed and housed and obviously hoping to get back to Japan sometime soon, but it was some time before they went.
Was it?
Indeed, I can jump, if you like, because having been in Singapore for a while, I then went up to Kuala Lumpur to join up the mobile section that had come with the zipper in from the Moray beaches up to KL, so I joined them there for a while. I don't actually remember anything much in the way of work. It was really it seemed rather a social time. Then I was recalled to India to join the force which was going to occupy Japan. And so I was sent back via Delhi and went down to Nasik, where inland from Bombay, where the British and Indian component of the anticipated Commonwealth occupation force were being put together.
Just before we leave Singapore, yes. Was anybody tempted to take revenge on the Japanese?
Of the locals, you mean?
Anybody at all?
Well, no, I don't think so. One of the memories I do have is quite early on. In fact, in the first day, I think it must have been, a truck came speeding down from Changi jail with a whole lot of released prisoners aboard, all of whom had put on their sort of best threadbare uniforms for the purpose. And I will remember one of them leaping off, I think a captain in the Indian Army, and saying to my Indian company commander, his name was Major Arbab, he said, you were one of my pupils at Staff College. What are you doing wearing those crowns? I thought it was a fairly sort of abrupt greeting. Arbab, being a polite Indian, shrugged it off, but I didn't feel very happy about that. But he was obviously bitter, having lost 3.5 years of his career, you see, in jail.
The crowns were a major's crowns.
Yes, Arbab was a major. This chap was a captain.
So you said you were at Nasik, joining this force for the occupation of Japan.
Yes, that was called Brinjap. It was being put together. You know about this, do you? The occupation.
Brinjap.
Yes, British Indian for Japan. I've written a book about it. You can have my book if you like. I'm sure it's in the museum actually. But there was an enormous lot of political argument between British and Australians and Americans about this occupation force. And the Australians wanted to have their own thing. Everett in particular was keen that the Australians should be recognized as a nation in their own right and have their own element of the occupation force and so on. It was really an enormous amount of negotiation. Amongst which, in the course of which, it was agreed that the commander of the force would be an Australian, and it would be supported from Australia in terms of logistics. That it was finally accepted. There would be a British brigade, Indian brigade, Australian brigade, and a New Zealand brigade, and they were all brought together from different places. The British and Indian brigades were formed up at Nasik. The Australian brigade was formed at Moratai in the Salibas. From selected personnel who'd volunteered from the four Australian divisions in that part of the world at that time. And the New Zealand Brigade was in Italy and was going to come home and was diverted to go to Japan instead. So it was kind of a mix-up. But the British and Indian brigades were formed specially for the purpose. So the British Brigade had an English battalion, a Scots battalion, and a Welsh battalion. The Indian Brigade had a Hindu battalion, that's Marathas, I was with the Marathas, had a Punjabi battalion, 5th First, and a Gurkha battalion. So it was a kind of, you know, the idea was to get a proper spread over the various elements that you find in those armies. And so we waited there while the political arguments went on and finally set sail for Japan in January 1946.
Where did you arrive in Japan?
At Kure, the big naval base. We'd been allocated quite a large part of Japan, actually. MacArthur eventually welcomed us because he was able to release a lot of his American soldiers to go back home, although he'd objected to on other grounds previously. So we had the whole of the island of Shikoku, and I spent a third of the Honshu, the mainland, of the main island. And Hiroshima was in our bit. And Kure was just up the coast from Hiroshima. It was a very big naval base, been badly bombed during the war, but it was where we, that was our port of disembarkation.
And what were you personally supposed to be doing there?
Well, I actually, amusingly enough, had been appointed baggage officer on the transport that was taking the headquarters, and it was quite fun actually because I got a very nice cabin which I shared with the ship's adjutant, who was who was later a film star, called Bill Lyndon Travers. He was later Bill Travers, you may have come across. He married Virginia McKenna, they did all this Born Free stuff. But he and I shared a marvelous cabin, and I had a week in Bombay loading the gear as baggage officer. It was extremely pleasant socially. Anyway, landed in Japan. Bryn Jap headquarters went off to Hiro with what was effectively another mobile section of SEATIC, although it couldn't be called SEATIC because it wasn't Southeast Asia anymore, so it's called SISDIC again. And we were distributed around the various units. I was sent off to join an Australian infantry battalion, or company, really, west of Hiroshima. It was a marvellous experience. And I was the only POM in this great collection of guys. And very high standard. They'd selected their personnel from volunteers throughout these Australian divisions I mentioned, as opposed to being part of a unit that's marched off, like the British and Indian brigades were. So they had a very high standard of personnel, many decorations. I mean, the company I joined had five officers, three got the MC, and very interesting, a lot. And for me, another experience, another different experience.
In what way were they so good?
Well, it's quite interesting. They combined extraordinary informality with great dedication to discipline and formality. I mean, on parade, off parade, off parade, you know, that sort of thing. And they were absolutely first-class soldiers as such. They'd all been through the Pacific operations, experienced people. But they had this other approach that I found refreshing. And I remember going out to a jeep one day. I had to make some trip somewhere, and I said to the driver, "Good day," I said. "What's your name?" He said, "White, sir." So I said, "Okay, White, let's go." "Oh," he said, "sir, you can't call me White. Private White or Bluey." So I said, "Okay, Bluey, let's go." That's the sort of attitude I rather liked. But at the same time, good discipline, very good soldiers indeed. Indeed, that particular battalion, which was 67 Battalion, eventually became 3 Battalion RAR, Royal Australian Regiment, and went to Korea as the first unit to go to Korea, Korean War.
And what kind of work were you supposed to be doing in Hiroshima?
Well, the only thing I can, not very much. I used to help in discussions with the mayor and the local administration. But basically, the irony of the Japanese occupation was that the Americans kept military government in their hands, and we weren't allowed to have any part of that, except in some sort of friendly association whenever it seemed to be a good idea. But by and large, we had no official role in military government. So my duties as such were mainly concerned with housekeeping, you know, making sure that our relations with our local authorities were okay, and we got the right sort of labour when we wanted it, and the brewery delivered when it was required, that sort of thing.
Why were you requiring labour?
Well, menial duties around the camp, I mean, cleaners, cooks, bottle washers, that sort of thing, as you get in any military installation.
And what did the attitude of Japanese you came across personally seem to be towards the presence of British force?
Ingratiating, I would say. They accepted we were there. The Americans had been there since the previous September, so we were just taking over from them. They were used to being occupied, you might say. They realized that they depended on the occupation, in many cases, for employment. We had contractors who were always keen to supply us with food or local purchased various kinds. And so there was an ingratiating approach from the population at large. However, the other aspect of that particular place, Otaki was where it was that we were looking after a repatriation depot, and that was quite different. This was bringing shiploads of soldiers back from all over the Far East, Manchuria, China, Southeast Asia, and processing them and sending them off home with a railway ticket and a set of clothes, and that was it. We were, as it were, this Australian company, which I was now part of, was sort of supervising this, although the actual work was done by Japanese government people in terms of the processing of the personnel. But we were there really to demonstrate that they were coming back to an occupied country. And we used to go out and climb up on these troop ships and sort of swagger around and show our Union Jacks on our shoulders and all that. That was interesting. And
Union Jacks?
Well, we had a shoulder flat Union Jack.
Was it the Australian flag?
No, on me, this was. We had a Beecoff flash there, what we call Beecoff, British Commonwealth Occupation Force. It was quite interesting because this was an old military camp which we were using as a repatriation center. So it was a big parade ground and enormous sort of cookhouses and so on. And if a Japanese soldier at the other side of the parade ground saw you at sort of 300 yards range, he would stop and salute. I mean, they were very much sort of aware that this was a good thing to do.
Were there any consequences if they did not?
No. It was there of their own volition, funnily enough.
How were the Aussies behaving towards the Japanese?
All right. They had no friction at all. In fact, when we were watching the passage of these repatriated soldiers, who were often in very bad shape, very sick, emaciated, bad state of health, there was a feeling of sort of sorrow or pity rather than anything else. They looked as if they had lost the war, and they had.
And their behaviour of the Australians towards the Japanese civilians?
Well, again, rather insulated in a way. I mean, obviously there was the usual chasing of women, you might say. But it's all rather well organised in Japan. Every town has its own little brothel or geisha house or whatever you might call it. They weren't geisha, they were prostitutes, really. But the troops were officially not allowed to fraternize, but of course there was fraternization going on. And not particularly harmful.
Was there any trouble with the soldiers?
No. Not there. There was trouble later on, and I wasn't present, when there was a tremendous conflict between Indian soldiers and Australian soldiers in Hero, both members of base units. They weren't combat units. They weren't particularly well disciplined, over women, which actually developed into a firefight at one stage. And it was quite a story. Again, I've described it in my book at some length. It was a tremendous court of inquiry took place, and I think a couple of Indians were shot. But that's a very, very unusual incident.
You mean they were squabbling over women?
Yes.
Were you happy in Japan?
Yes, I enjoyed it. I was only there for 6 months, I suppose. It was a lovely country. I mean, after the Indians arrived, I rejoined my Maratha battalion, who were up on the north coast. The south coast of Honshu, by the Inland Sea, Hiroshima, Kure, enormous damage. We didn't even think about radiation in those days, but you know, it wasn't a good place to be. On the north coast, where the Marathas went, a place called Hamanab, lovely, wonderful piece of coastline, fishing villages, good weather in those days, and that was super. Very good indeed.
What was the state of the Japanese civilians in 1946, from your observation?
Well, in Hiroshima and around there, very poor. Very poor. I mean, in a bad way. But they were surviving. They were making a living as best they could. Out in the country, of course, it was much easier, particularly the fishing and farming areas. They had enough food, and they were removed from the awful bombing that the big cities had suffered. And so that was quite different. They were quite happy.
And after your 6 months in Japan?
Well, I had way back in Burma responded to an army council instruction soliciting applications for the colonial service after the war, particularly the Far East. And I was rather taken by this. I liked the East, and it sort of seemed to be a good idea. So I had put in an application which finally, about a year and 2 months later, matured into a signal summoning me back to Simla for interview. So I trudged all the way back from Japan with a low priority air ticket by RAF for transport. Kind of interesting. Shanghai, marvelous place to visit at that time. Chinese communists, Americans, a whole lot. White Russians trying to get out. Hong Kong, Saigon, and then Calcutta and Delhi and similar. So I got all the way back there. It took about a week or more, about 10 days, I suppose. And I had a very pleasant interview with two chaps who were most intrigued to meet somebody that's come back from Japan. They were from the colonial office. And they said, great. And I said, well, we'd like you to join. And the next thing will be is you'll have to go back for a final interview in London. And then you'll go either to Oxford or Cambridge on this Devonshire course that we're planning for an academic year, after which you will be posted to the colony of your or their choice. So I said, well, that sounds fine. I'm not interested in going anywhere but Malaya, by the way. I thought I could make that point straight away. Anyway, so I went all the way back to Japan, same sort of laborious, interesting air route, packed up my gear there, and then went all the way back to England by the same laborious route. So about some weeks, yes, came back to England, was released under Class B release, I think it was called, and final interview, and went off to Oxford in the October for my academic year. It was called the Devonshire course. And that was great. We were treated as undergraduates. There were two or three of my old friends who had come through the same process, had ended up in the same place. And at the end of, and I became a member of Lincoln College, which was fun. I had a rewarding time in Oxford, but was quite happy to leave when the time came because I wasn't doing a degree course and I was getting excited, impatient with what we were doing. Although it was quite a well-constructed course, it was a series of subjects were established which was thought to be important, like colonial history, colonial economics, and various things of that kind, law, and we had good teachers, Hancock on the economic side, Marjorie Perham, you may have known, in the colonial history side. And at the end of the year, we had a module where we were seconded to local government authorities in this country, so I get sort of a flavour of how they dealt with things here. And a great friend of mine and I, who had been at Oxford for this year, managed to get ourselves seconded to the Oxford City Council, so we stayed on. And we stayed on in my rector's lodgings, as it happened, for a month. And then the next 3 months, up to the end of the year, we went back to SOAS. I went back for a Malay course this time. And set sail for Malaya in December.
How did you find Malaya compared with the Japanese?
Oh, easy, very easy. Yes. Actually, Japanese, spoken Japanese, is not difficult. Once you've got hold of the honorifics and the different ways of talking to people of different ranks, it's not a difficult language. It has no tonal problems like Chinese dialects have. But Malay is even easier, and I enjoyed it. It's very, very good.
So you got your job in the colonial service in Malaya?
Yes, I was in the colonial administrative service. Actually, I was in the Malayan Civil Service, the MCS, and I stayed for from 47 until 55.
So you were there when the emergency broke out?
Yes, I was. I was in the middle of all that. Yes, for part of my time I was in that. I was in the secretary. Well, I was in a district in Negros Sembilan called Kuala Pila to start with. I was attached to the district office there. And it was then that the emergency sort of broke on us, as you might say. June 48, the first planters were killed, the emergency was declared. And I, by that time, had become quite familiar with the district. I mean, I'd been all over the place and knew it well. And so I was seconded with the police because they felt that they needed somebody with the knowledge I'd accumulated. And so I became an assistant superintendent of police for a while. A great friend of mine was the chief police officer there, so it went very well. And then after two or three months of that, which involved searching the jungle for various suspected terrorists and doing a certain amount of liaison with the civil population and the civil authority with this new emergency situation on our hands, I was plucked out of it by the establishment office back in Kuala Lumpur and posted back to the Treasury. Which I mean, even now, I can hardly believe it happened. But anyway, I was a young and enthusiastic officer, and my mistake then was to do the job as well as I could. If I'd made a mess of it, I'd have been posted out some lovely district on the East Coast, and it would have been so much more pleasant. But there was. I did it rather too well. And so I stayed in the secretariat in the Treasury for the next couple of years. And then at last I got a posting as a district officer. And this was to Cameron Highlands.
Just before we go on to that, if I can ask you about this place, was it Kuala Pila?
Yes.
How do you spell it?
P-I-L-A-H. Kuala, K-U-A-L-A, Pila.
And were the...
That's in Negros Sembilan.
Were the enemy strong in that area?
No, not really. Although there'd been a considerable... communist cell built up in the rubber estates at a place called Bahau, which is not far from Kuala Pila, more part of the same district. And so, and when the emergency was declared, the leaders took off into the jungle, but didn't stay in the area. I think they went a long way off. I benefited to the extent that I was awarded a rather nice car by the police, which one of these chaps had left behind, so at least I had some transport.
Were any of the enemy as individuals known to you in Kuala Pila?
No, not to me. They were known to the police, but not to me. No.
So were they conducting any kind of operations in your part of Negros Sembilan?
No, I don't think so. I don't think. I mean, there was a certain amount of what shall I say? The police were very short on intelligence, and I think back to my military days. They had a special branch which was concerned with keeping track of the political activities and so on, but not very good at district level. At national level, quite effective, I think. But so, as far as Kuala Pila was concerned, there had been a number of activists who disappeared into the jungle. Nobody knew where they'd gone to. And what we were trying to do was try to find out where they had gone, actually, and what support they were getting from the population behind.
What support do you think they were getting?